Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what appears to be dark days, if not years, descending on Egypt, where the military government is issuing mass death sentences on hundreds of supporters of the ousted Muslim Brotherhood government for the death of one policeman. Khaled El-Gindi, a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, joins us to discuss the dashed hopes for democracy in Egypt, where the popular backlash against the incompetent Morsi government has given the military and their Saudi backers a blank check and an opportunity to turn back the clock. Then we'll examine the arguments before the Supreme Court in a case which could allow business owners to refuse to comply with the Affordable Care Act's provisions to cover the birth control needs of female employees. Jody Jacobson, the president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, joins us to discuss whether or not the Supreme Court will open a Pandora's box that would sanction bigotry and anti-science ignorance, allowing businesses to refuse service to LGBT customers on religious grounds and parents to refuse to immunize their kids based on biblical interpretations. Then finally, we will speak with the veteran reporter and best-selling author William Grider, whose latest book is Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. He joins us to discuss his article at The Nation, Spy Agencies, Not Politicians, Hold the Cards in Washington, and the extent to which the Washington portrayed in the TV hit series House of Cards exaggerates the power and mendacity of politicians when it is, as Grider suggests, the spooks and the spies who shuffle the deck and deal the cards. And joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And the New York Times is just carrying an editorial about Egypt that's as though sort of dark days are descending on Egypt, an alarming downward spiral, they refer to. The idea that 529 people have been charged with the murder of killing one police officer somewhat strikes me about it's almost reminiscent of World War II in occupied France, where if the French resistance killed a German soldier, the Germans retaliated by killing 500 French villagers. You think that's a fair analogy in terms of overkill?
Well, it's certainly overkill. I suppose I don't know enough about World War II history to say whether, you know, it's an exact analogy, but there's no question that this is, you know, an egregious violation of due process. I mean, it was a sham of a process, I think, in every way, and it was clearly, I think that was clear to anyone who looked at it objectively. I think the New York Times editorial is exactly right, that Egypt, it is a sign, I think, of this continuing downward spiral that we've seen not just over the last 3 years, but specifically since July. We've seen a number of mass arrests and mass killings and mob violence, attacks on journalists, both by the state and by sort of street mobs. And it's extremely, extremely disturbing, I think, and you know, it's hard to imagine what sort of state of mind, you know, Egyptian authorities have to be in to think that these sorts of measures will in any way lead to stability. I think quite the opposite.
Well, the New York Times editorial concludes saying that inexplicably the United States and Britain issued separate, similarly weak statements which said that they were deeply concerned about the death sentences. That's unlikely to have much of effect on Egypt's military and a population that largely seems willing to tolerate its abuses. What's your sense? You're there in Washington. Why is the White House and the State Department so tepid?
Well, I think when it comes to Egypt, there's a great deal of confusion in the administration, and frankly, even beyond Washington, there's a lot of confusion as to what exactly is happening in Egypt, why authorities are taking the measures that they are, and there's a real loss, I think, for you know, alternatives. I think the administration has simply decided Egypt is going to do what it's going to do, and it's best if they sort of stay out of it and try to incur minimal damage along the way. I think that's the basic calculation. I think the what sort of is behind that is this sense of powerlessness, that anything the United States says or does is likely to backfire or simply fall on deaf ears or not work. So the calculation that they seem to have made is, well, let's just, you know, do the absolute minimum that we need to do. And I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, it's something much stronger than the kinds of words and statements that we've seen needs to be done. But at the same time, the U.S. is walking a very delicate line, because Egypt is not just about Egypt. It's also about Egypt's neighborhood. Obviously, there's the situation in Syria, which complicates the entire regional situation. There's the ongoing issue with Iran. And when it comes to Egypt in particular, the two closest U.S. allies in the region, Israel and Saudi Arabia, are very happy with how this Egyptian regime is behaving. So I think, you know, the calculation the administration is making is not just in relation to Egypt and not wanting to annoy that government, but also with an eye on its other allies in the region.
Again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. So President Obama goes to Saudi Arabia on Friday. And there's no question that the Saudis support this military government, that they're against the uprising against Mubarak. There are reports at the time of Tahrir Square that every day the Saudi king was on the phone yelling at Obama, saying, you've got to let Mubarak shoot those kids and stop this. And it's pretty clear that the Saudi Arabians do not want this kind of model of governance to compete with their model of governance, because they're sitting on a powder keg at home, I imagine, being, you know, essentially a feudal state with no parliament, no democracy, nothing that resembles anything that we would consider a democracy. Essentially you're entirely dependent upon the largesse of the royal family.
I think that's basically correct. I think you know, the Saudis were clearly unhappy with Mubarak's departure and the American position in allowing that, or acquiescing in it, at least. And they were even more upset with the election of a Muslim Brotherhood member to the presidency. I think what the Saudis saw, the danger of, obviously, any sort of transition to genuine democracy poses a threat to a regime like the Saudi monarchy. And it's something that they would not want to see spread. And having this happen in the largest, most populous, and arguably most important Arab state was a clear danger. Now, add on top of that, the first elected president is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and all of the red flags are up as far as the Saudis are concerned. And they saw an opportunity, I think, last year, in the middle of last year, when there was widespread discontent with Morsi's rule, the same opportunity that I think the Egyptian military saw, which was to, in a way, turn back the clock. And if we can just make this all go away, they and the region will be much better off.
But that's the feeling that I get, is that there's an unreal quality to this, Khalid El-Gindi, that the idea that you can turn the clock back, that you can go back to a military government funded in part by the Saudi monarchy, who spent something like, they in the Gulf have spent something like $32 billion. I don't know whether at the end of the day there's ever going to be anything to show for it. How could you have a viable government that oppresses or outlaws about, what, 40% of its own population?
Yeah, I mean, I think the percentages are not clear. I'm not sure that the Brotherhood represents 40% of the population, but clearly they are. They were and are the largest organized opposition force, even after the crackdown and the crushing by the military and the police. I think they are still a potent political force that command the sympathies of a significant number of Egyptians. It's also true that a very significant number of Egyptians have turned against the Brotherhood, or were always against the Brotherhood. You know, the Brotherhood's relative popularity aside, or unpopularity, it's clear that you cannot simply wish away or legislate away or ban a political opposition group that is as old and deeply entrenched as the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think it is bound to fail. The problem is that clearly the Saudis and the Egyptian regime don't see things that way. They think you can turn back the clock, and they think that they have turned back the clock. You know, you just said a moment ago that you can't go back to a military government. Well, we've gone back to a military government in Egypt, and we've gone back to a repressive regime, and it's one that actually has fairly broad popular support. So for the time being, it looks like it's quite doable because it's being done. I'm not sure that it's sustainable over the long term or indefinitely, because it is it's such a destabilizing force. I think they've essentially miscalculated on two fronts. The first is to assume that somehow you can rely on the state institutions like the judiciary, like the police and the interior ministry that were extremely corrupt, and one of the many reasons why you had an uprising in 2011 to begin with, that somehow you can rely on these failed and corrupt institutions today when they weren't really working properly 3 or 4 years ago. I think that's the first miscalculation. The other miscalculation is to assume that the public will acquiesce in this kind of repression indefinitely. I think as it becomes clearer over time that this regime is incapable, actually, of addressing Egypt's serious social and economic problems, then I think we might see a different type of dynamic as far as public opinion is concerned. But right now, you know, the average Egyptian is not terribly concerned about rights or about democracy or about due process. They're concerned about power outages, the economy, unemployment, sort of day-to-day governance and services that are not being met. And, you know, for now, they're willing to sort of give the regime a very long leash. But I'm not sure how long that will last.
Well, Khalid El-Gindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Sure, you're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Khalid El-Gindi, who's a fellow with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about arguments before the Supreme Court that could open a Pandora's box sanctioning bigotry and anti-science ignorance.